This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakweowasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji.
You know, we learned to produce daily bread, but then we became too widespread. And looking ahead from the stuff that I've read, now we are all become dead. Hee-haw!
And now we are all become dead. Thanks for reminding me of the 72nd anniversary of that moment when we became Death, the Destroyer of Worlds, when we slaughtered more than 200,000 innocent civilians. Listen with me to a moment of live J. Robert Oppenheimer as he gives context to those immortal words.
He knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Chilling words because they speak a chilling truth. Eco-psychologist Zewa Woodbury speaks eloquently about the contribution of this pivotal event to the American national character. He blogs at planetary-hospice.com, and his recently released book is titled Climate Sense. My friend Takashi Tanimori was less than a mile from the epicenter, an 8-year-old second-grade student. Listen with me now to his recollection of the event.
August 6, 1945, 8:15, at school clock stopped. It was that moment the explosion took place. But before the explosion took place, I saw the pure white lightning, entire sky, just pure white. I have never seen such a white colors. I was at the school, second grade student, in a three-storage wood frame school. Entire school, of course, scattered like matches. First things I remember, it's pitch dark. I cannot see my hands in front of my eyes. Then suddenly I smell the heat. Just like you put your entire body in a big heated oven. And air, oxygen, if you please, the confiscated. And I was scratching. And later I saw all the finger marks from my neck down to chest. and I wondered why. Then I remembered gasping the airs. Then the second thing I saw there under the debris, pitch dark. As I say, I couldn't see the fingers of my hand. Yet I saw the reddish yellow, red, the flame leaping out as if were the serpent's tongue. Then I began to hear the scream of my classmate, my best friend, Taro, who used to live in the two houses down. He said, "Takashi, Takashi, please come rescue me. I'm burning." One by one, I remember the five classmates screaming for mom, daddy's coming to save them. "Can I help you?" Because I was under the debris. And I cried, my daddy, and they moved the debris one by one. The finally one soldier clutched me in his arm. I felt the strength of the soldiers. I felt I was safe and secure. Then did you know, as we were passing through, weaving through in and out, there was a man, elderly man, unrecognizable, asked the soldier for water. The soldier said, "I do not have water." And he just made clung to him, said, "There, would you pull me out of misery?" A few minutes later, I saw the woman in front of us, about 5 feet from us, passing by, screaming, calling the name of her children. Then as I saw her passing by, I saw she had a baby on her back, headless. I met my father in Jessen by the river called Tema River. Behind the school, we had a sandy beach in the early morning since the tide was out. And there are thousands and thousands of people there on the river embankment, pushing, shoving, and the infernos in the 30 feet from the embankment. Just then, the rain started coming down, the black rain. Rain coming down and the river has risen, and the hundreds people just washed away. In this mess of all this, my father found me as he called my name. "Takashi, Takashi," I responded, "That's my daddy," I told the soldiers. So anyway, soldier turned me over to my father's, and he took me in his arms. Even to this day, 4 years later, I still feel his strength and the warmth as he embraced me. The tide decreased, but we crossed the bridge made of all the debris and human bodies piled. We walked to the other side of the river, to the train station, on the bridge, I call it human bridge. Hot summer days, sun was beating upon us on the little country road. Then all of a sudden, the sun was covered, the black cloud that I thought it was. No, tens of thousands of black flies just swarming, and they are landing there, lavishing our wound.
Trapped under debris while listening to the anguished cries of classmates succumbing to the flames, fleeing the apocalypse in the arms of an enemy soldier, a dying elder begging for a merciful bullet, a mother carrying the headless body of her dead baby and calling for her other lost children, crossing a river on a bridge made of broken infrastructure and human bodies, a solar eclipse due not to the distant intervening presence of the moon, but to the descent of swarming black carrion-eating flies. How could the son of a samurai forgive the perpetrators of these atrocities? You can find out about Takashi-san's journey from vengeance to forgiveness in his book, Bridge to Forgiveness. But can we ever forgive ourselves? I don't know about you, dear listeners, but I will be engaging in purification ceremony during this moon cycle, especially in 2 weeks' time during the solar eclipse. Fire is the element of purification, and the sun is the home of the fire elemental, source of fire for warmth, for light, for food production, preparation, and preservation, for protection from predators, for forging of steel and ceramics. What a gift! But the gift has a shadow, as Prometheus found to his eternal regret. It's Thursday, the 3rd of August, and I've got Barry Snyder back with me today, and we're going to talk about the upcoming solar eclipse on 21 August. I also did a little research on the Perseid meteor shower.
Yeah.
So we can give everybody a heads up that that meteor shower is happening. The peak is the night of the 12th through the pre-dawn hours of the 13th.
Yeah.
And they're talking a ZHR of 80 to 100 meteors per hour.
That's about right. Yeah, it's littler one a minute as I've experienced. Yeah.
Yeah, not that those of us who aren't fortunate enough to be in a fire watch tower are going to see that many, but if you can get away, conditions have to be ideal, especially because the moon is going to be just past full and it's going to bleach out a good bit of the sky. So what you need to do to get your maximum impact, first of all, get away from the city lights and put the moon behind you and look about two-thirds of the way up from the horizon. And that's how you get your maximum impact, according to the article that I read at space.com.
Very good.
So, again, dealing with the fire elemental, going back to solar science, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit. Meteors are spawned by comets, is what I could sort of get from my reading on Wikipedia. Yeah. And comets are ice, not fire.
Mm-hmm.
And meteors are fire. How does that happen?
Well, they're only fire in the sense that when they come into the upper atmosphere, they ignite.
Oh, that's what sets them off. I know, because in space, nothing can burn in space. There's no oxygen. Yeah. Okay, now I understand what they were saying when they said that the particles that make the meteorites are in synchronous orbit with the comet.
Yeah. And
when they happen to cross into the atmosphere.
Some of them get caught by the gravitational field of the Earth, and they're pulled down into the atmosphere. And as the further they go into the atmosphere, the more they accelerate due to the force of gravity towards the Earth. And so they go faster and the atmosphere gets thicker and it provides the resistance or friction to cause them to catch fire.
Enormous long tails. I was really shocked to learn that they range in size from a grain of sand to about a grape. And we're worried about being hit by one of those? Never happened, huh? People worry about it though. Isn't that what wiped out the dinosaurs?
When I first was at the lookout, one of my first real ahas was on a real clear autumn evening when the full moon rose, and I had my 10 power binoculars. I looked at it and I looked, oh my God, the thing is just pockmarked with craters. You look at the moon, it is just, it has been pummeled with stuff from space, and it's just nothing but craters everywhere. And I went, my goodness. And every so often, one of them is big enough that when it comes into the atmosphere, it doesn't burn up by the time it hits the Earth. And when it does hit, like down in the Yucatan, killed off the dinosaurs, it creates such an incredible explosion and so much stuff got released up into the air. Earthquakes, debris that blocked the sun out.
And that's from a little teeny tiny particle. It's accelerated so much that it packs that much of a punch. Is that it?
That thing was a lot bigger than that. It was pretty good size. There's one in northern Arizona, a crater there that's, I don't know how many miles across. You can go drive right up and look at it.
Well, the crater is miles across, but the object that impacts, that creates that crater.
Much smaller. Yeah, it could have been the size of a basketball. I don't know.
Maybe. Just trying to imagine the enormous momentum that would have to be in Greece to create that size impact.
Yeah, they're going mighty fast.
So are you going to be up in your tower watching the meteor shower?
Yes, and I'll be watching the eclipse too with my eclipse glasses.
I also want to take a moment, which I never did give you an opportunity to do the first time, to tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and where you come from, what your academic background is, any publications, what you actually do in the months that you're not being a fire watcher, what you do for a livelihood, and how we can contribute to that.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's really two parts of my life. The early part of my life, I was very much into business. My undergraduate training was in chemistry, but when I got out, I realized that that wasn't going to be something that going to take me in a direction I wanted to go. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I wound up in banking due to the fact that my grandfather was a president of a bank. I got into banking and pretty much liked it, became very successful at it, and had this idea of becoming very wealthy at a very young age so that I could be free and not have to work, and I was going to own my own corporation, things of that nature. And I was well on the road to doing that when I had a crisis. And that crisis, my life really basically fell apart. It put me on a spiritual path. And eventually, I came to a point where I realized I could not continue in banking for many reasons. Number one, I would lose my soul. And two, I was doing things that were very unethical, that were harming the planet. And actually, I had to face at one point that I was going to be killing people if I financed a company that would be making nose cones and tail assemblies for air-to-surface missiles. That was my watershed moment that caused me to leave a job that in the 80s was making six figures with a company car, expense account, and enormous benefits and retirement that would have had me very wealthy and retired long before now, and take a backpack and go to Asia, find out what all these God-realized beings are about. And that started this other whole part of my life, which is really what my life has been about since then. It's been a spiritual journey and many awakenings, been studied with many enlightened awakened beings. And for the past 30 years, have focused my life on that primarily. The fire lookout is what I do in the summer to provide necessary income so I don't have to be reliant on my spiritual work. I have a great deal of conflict about doing that. I don't want, it muddies it.
Yes, thank you for saying that.
We never charge. We receive contributions that people feel to give from their heart. You know, we say, do what your heart and soul tell you to do. But our whole thing has been to help people wake up, because what happened as I woke up and I looked at the state of the planet, I realized that the fundamental issue here is human consciousness. And until there's a change in human consciousness, all these things that were threatening us as a species are not going to change, because they all are the result of human consciousness. It's our perception, how we perceive life, the world, how we think, all that is reflected out there in what we've done. So that's what set me on my journey, because I realized the planet wasn't going to make it if we didn't have a shift in consciousness. We've done this work with people for 30 years. I met my partner and then became wife shortly after I had my awakenings. We've been together for 27 years, and we've worked together as a team. It's really great to have the masculine and feminine, you know, in this. And we've done workshops, groups all over North America, Hawaii, done a lot of teleconferences more recently. We haven't done as much traveling in recent years, haven't felt to. We've written three books. The Birthing the Luminous Self trilogy is published. You can see it on Amazon. The fourth book is out. It's being taken to a published number of publishers right now. And the working title of that is Taking Off Overcoats, A Simple Loving Approach to Awakening. And I am working on a fifth that I will not reveal the title yet. But it's about this process of awakening that's occurring now at this crucial time on the planet. The kind of things we're talking about and much, much more that I hope to get out ASAP. I'm working on it every day that I can. I probably won't go to a publisher because I think it's too timely. I may just put it out in a PDF because it needs to be now.
So many people are finding that that's true. It's certainly true in the science world as well. By the time you get through the peer review process, your paper is obsolete.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to hear more about what that experience as a fire watcher is like, both on a logistical basis and also on an inner or personal level, especially as tuned in as you are to solar science and you're out there looking at or looking for fires. What is that like for you?
Susan, I've been doing it for 21 years. I started it in the middle of a career crisis, didn't know what I was going to do. A friend who had written a book about fire lookout said, well, why don't you just go out in the mountain and sit for a summer as a fire lookout and figure out what you're going to do with your life? And that was 21 years ago, and I'm still doing it. And now my wife is actually doing it too. 2 years later, she got her own fire lookout. It is such a unique and rare opportunity to be completely out in nature for a whole summer by yourself on a mountaintop, and to become so completely immersed in nature, in the elementals, I sleep on the ground at night in a tent all summer. The deer come by my tent. Matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, a bear cub got my tent and tore it to shreds. That's, you know, the world I live in. But I love that world because, and maybe this does come back around to the eclipse too. It's about going back to the earth and the feminine. And well, believe it or not, my path originally was very much Eastern. I had a Hindu guru. It's so eclectic. Christ came into my life because I think it involves everything. If it doesn't involve everything, if you can't put all the pieces into the circle, then I don't think you can ever get to understand what reality is. So my journey has always been, if there's another piece I don't understand, throw it the hell in the circle until we figure out what it is, you know, and just sit with it until it shows itself. So the lookout for me came as an opportunity after many years of intense spiritual practice and powerful awakenings to go out and integrate. To sit myself on a mountain and feel myself spread out to infinity almost. You know, I'm looking out for 20, 30 miles in every direction through a building. It's glass, 3-story building. Picture a metal structure like a tower with a glass enclosure on the top. It's also a living environment. And you sit there and you look out all the time. So I look at nothing human, zero. There's nothing human that I see. It's all wilderness. And what that time did for me was to unfold another whole aspect of my being and consciousness. To me, it was that belly center, that Hara Tan Tien, that connection with the Great Mother, with life. I slowly began to become more subtly aware of the nuances of everything. I can get up in the morning and I can walk up on my tower from my tent. I can feel the air, look at the direction of the air, just get the quality of the air, look at the sky. And I can tell you a thunderstorm is coming. It's completely from another dimension of consciousness. Yeah, the intellect is involved in looking at a southeast flow of air. I can tell you all kinds of things that means about low pressure systems and movements of air. I could talk about that forever. I could talk about relative humidity, feeling that. But it's something that being out there, all this integrates and clicks into a deeper sense of life, reality, oneself. That as we talked last time, I think we have so much more in terms of our sensory capacities. And that's what this time has been most amazing about to me. It's naked face-to-face with the elementals, with the innate consciousness of life, the mother. It's in every living thing. And coming into a sense of unity with it is really what it's been about for me.
It seems to me it would be a very humbling experience too.
Oh, very, very.
The vastness of infinity and the enormous power of the elementals. And
I nearly died up on that lookout 1 year from hypothermia. Mm. From my own issues almost got me, really. It's very humbling in the sense that Mother Nature is the clear mirror. She shows you where you are really, really fast. In other words, you can live in the matrix of our cultural society where you're isolated from that by so many conveniences and things that connect us to this psychosphere that's basically largely illusory and disconnected with life. When you go out there, you find out all that falls away. And there you are, naked with yourself, face to face with her. And she really mirrors back to you in a loving way where you are. And that's really been the story of these 21 years, is seeing myself in life more clearly, understanding how it works. I've been driven off that mountain by firestorms. It made such an indelible mark on me about the power of the fire element. It is overwhelming. It's transformative to see a fire burn so hot that it creates its own weather.
Yeah.
It will pull in drafts that are 40, 50 miles an hour. Create towering pyrocumulus clouds that are bigger than cumulonimbus clouds. In 2014, I witnessed one develop in this fire. It was so intense that it went up to 45,000 feet high, started 12 more fires on the district I work on, plus ignited a whole bunch of fires on another district that burned to 150,000 acres just from that one pyrocumulus cloud.
So it's kind of a toss-up whether the fire is going to get you or the hypothermia.
Yeah, it's all part of the experience. When I watch the moon come up on a full moon, I'm so high that with good binoculars, I can literally see the relief on the moon. Looking around the edge of it, I can see the craters. I can see it's three-dimensional. It is an amazing experience.
It has a terrain. It's not just shadows. It's an actual terrain, yeah?
It's a real physical thing. It just completely changes your consciousness to see that. I could talk forever about it, but that's really what it's about. It's getting me more deeply connected with life. life itself.
I'm going to ask you a really mundane personal question. Is that a livelihood or are you a volunteer?
No, I'm actually an employee of the U.S. Forest Service for about 4.5 months of the year, from May till October. That's what the fire season is. Well, it keeps getting longer. It used to go from late May, early June to early October. Now it can start as early May and go into November.
Well, I'm tempted to try to link that back to what we were talking about last time about the weakening of the magnetic field around the Earth. Does that have anything to do with the lengthening of the fire season, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
Global warming. The planet's getting warmer. Where I work, I've had many of the old, quote-unquote, old-timers would come and tell me about the winters that we used to have, the cycles of rain, when they would come, how much snow accumulation. We're having nothing like that now.
Hmm.
It's getting drier, and it's getting hotter. And the fire seasons are now extending 5 to 7 weeks beyond what they used to. And that's why we're having all these violent fires everywhere on the planet.
Well, I know in Southern California, they're talking about there is no fire season anymore. It's just all year.
No, it's year round.
Yeah.
Get used to it. This is the new normal.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more specifically where you're actually located?
Sure. I'm in extreme Northern California in the coastal range, about an hour from the Oregon border. I'm above the Trinity Alps, and the Marble Mountains are above me. I sit looking down at the Salmon River drainage. One of the most pristine salmon runs in the country happens in that river. I sit in the mountain looking at all that.
And this is basically boreal forest type ecosystem?
Yeah, it's primarily coniferous, although in the canyons we do have some deciduous trees, but it's mostly fir trees, pines.
Mixed forest. Okay. I'm wanting to contrast it with what's going on in Siberia. They're having a lot of trouble with wildfires too, but that's all peat bog. That burns even hotter, doesn't it?
Where I literally work has probably some of the top fire behavior in the whole world.
Really?
Yes. Yes. That's known. I've had people from Australia come, from Europe come. When we have these big fires, people will come from all over the world to fight them with us. They get so big that we can't handle them with the U.S. resources. It's because in Northern California, we have two distinct seasonal cycles. In the winter, we have a northwest influence where we get damp, cold, wet winter. But then in the summer, we get a desert southwest influence and the high pressure expands and we get a desert southwest climate from May until sometime in October. So it will stop raining in May and then it won't rain until November. And it gets extremely dry after a winter that's been very wet that promotes a lot of growth.
Mm-hmm.
We get tremendous density of trees, undergrowth, and then all of a sudden it dries out to nothing. And we have slopes there in the coastal range that are 45 to 80% slope in the mountains, very steep canyons. And fire is driven by many things, but among them, it's the slope that the fire is on. If it's on a steep slope, it runs up that slope very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you also then have wind effects on those slopes. So we have violent fire behavior that can burn, you know, thousands of acres in a day. And it's so hot, the fires are so hot that they can't be fought, really. Human beings don't put fires out. Mother Nature allows them to put them out and helps them put them out. That's really the truth.
So it's more a matter of containment and facilitating evacuation when appropriate?
And the kind of big fires we get, they'll try to build indirect line. They'll start way far away from it and build a fire line around it and then try to burn back and contain it. But if a fire decides it wants to burn, there's nothing can be done with airplanes, people, helicopters, bulldozers to stop them. Can't, just can't. Any person in fire will tell you that.
That's very humbling.
It's very humbling. It's yeah. Very humbling and incredible respect. What I find with firefighters is they have a tremendous respect, not only for fire, but for Mother Nature. And they live in the mystery. They don't know. They know they don't know. And that's how they approach fighting fires.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at pinina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Whatever gave human beings the notion that such places were suitable for habitation? when they're subject to such an enormous threat on a seasonal basis. I mean, this is no surprise. This isn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing. This is an annual event, right?
Susan, it didn't used to be a problem. When these forests were first populated by white Western men, basically it was the gold rush in the 1840s and late 40s and 50s, really brought them to this country. It was greed. They were looking for gold. I sit right on top of some of the richest gold deposits that we discovered. But the forests were very different. The trees were very large, very high canopies. They were in a different mix of trees. There were a lot of what are called sugar pines, Douglas firs, and the understory was very minimal. You could walk through this forest, and the tree spacing was 10 times what it is today. And the Native Americans burned the forest every fall. They were so in touch, they knew when to burn and how to burn. So what they would do, they would start appropriate fires, and to keep burning that understory away, they would be creeping fires. They would go along, clean out the underbrush. They would re-alkalinize the soil, which is critical in a pine forest, because they tend to be acidic. So it would create ash, re-alkalinize the soil, create minerals and nutrients for the soil, would promote healthy undergrowth, prevent seedlings and things from getting up to the point where they could transfer fire up into the crowns of the trees and create crowning fires or devastating fires. It just happened. It was normal. It worked that way.
So when there's not so much understory, the fire can get through without actually killing the trees. It just wipes out the understory.
In Alaska, it's still the same way because they didn't suppress. Now, here's another thing about humanity and humanity's arrogance and ignorance. How this all started was, or I think it was 1910 or 12 in that area, there were violent catastrophic fires in the U.S., in the West. From the Rockies to the coast, millions upon millions of acres burned. Raging fires swept through the landscape and wiped out towns. People died. It was a catastrophe. A huge major outcry in the country about these fires. We have to do something about these fires. The U.S. Forest Service was formed shortly thereafter. Uh-huh. And the first mission was to fight these wildfires. And the then head of the Forest Service made a statement that wildfires are bad and they must be suppressed at all costs. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, starting 100 years ago, it was about suppressing fires. And it was all basically a very militaristic approach. If you even look at the terminology, we have battalions, captains, air attack. We do initial attack on a fire. It's an enemy that we attack. It's a mindset. And so we've suppressed these fires. And what happened was, where I am, instead of these X number of trees per acre, we now have 10X trees per acre. All these little fir trees come in. They're so thick, you can't even walk through them half the places. And there's what are called ladder fuels, so that when fires get started, they can propagate upward very rapidly. They get up in the crowns of the trees, and then they run. Mm. And you have this catastrophic, violent fire behavior.
Across the canopy instead of across the understory.
It'll take everything out. Once it starts, it just takes everything out. Why did that happen? It happened because we said fire is bad and we have to suppress it. We could not see that fire is a natural part of the ecosystem. And that's where they're stuck now. They're trying to back out of it, but now the problem is so compounded and so difficult that if you let them burn, they're catastrophic. So you're in a loop. And that's what the Forest Service is struggling with.
They're catastrophic because people have set up their dwelling places there and their livelihoods and such.
They're catastrophic because when it burns, they burn so hot that what is left is a landscape of baked clay where all the microbes and living organisms in the soil are dead. The fire is that hot.
It actually cooks the earth.
It looks like adobe.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing living. Reclaiming that forest is not going to happen. And as rapidly as the ecosystem is moving north, like down the Los Padres National Forest, which is down in the mountains above LA, that's going to be where I am in 50 years or less, that ecosystem. It's moving north.
Hmm.
And Bill McKibben's right. The nature's not going to keep up with that kind of movement. Things can't move as fast as this ecosystem shift is changing due to the increased heat.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it with my own eyes. I've watched it in 21 years happening. It's happening right where I am.
Speaking of greed and ignorance, let's pause a moment and listen to a reading of Tim Barrett's poem, And Then There Were None, read by Deba Cale Earnshaw.
7 billion earthlings, many in a fix. The greed of a few killed multitudes. and then there were 6. 6 billion earthlings killing all alive. They ran out of wildlife, and then there were 5. 5 billion earthlings, disease to the fore. The pills culture failed them, and then there were 4. 4 billion earthlings, just like you and me. The planet now begins to boil, and then there were 3. 3 billion earthlings, surrounded now by poo. The oceans washed the stuff ashore, and then there were 2. 2 billion earthlings. The earth is nearly done. The trees are gone. No crops can grow. And then there was 1. 1 billion earthlings. The planet is now done. They all went and killed themselves. And then there were none. And then there were none. By Tom Barrett.
Thank you, Deba. And thanks also to Guy McPherson for his initial reading on the June Nature Bat's Last podcast and for providing me with the script. So how does that feel when you go to your tower and you know that it's an exercise in futility because nature will have her way no matter what you do?
You know, there's all kinds of places I go with it, Susan. One place I go is, well, if we can somehow suppress these a little more for a while until we can work our way through the issues we have, there are ways to resolve this. But it requires political will, getting out of our own way to solve this. That I hope that maybe we'll get to that point, that will happen. I'm not sure that it will. And I feel that I have a larger purpose there. I feel that I'm one of the keepers of the earth. I sit in this mountain and I hold a prayerful, respectful place for life there. And I have a great love of this place. And I know that that's what the native people did. They were part of this continuum of the web of life that was connected with the earth, felt a great love and reverence with the earth, were, you know, and really honored her. That held the web of life together. I'm just trying to do that whatever way I can.
Okay, that sounds like a really good segue into talking about the eclipse, because you're predicting that one of the psycho-spiritual effects of the eclipse is a shift in consciousness, an illumination of the difficulties that we face, and a shift in consciousness about our approach to those difficulties. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there was an astrologer mystic named Dane Rudyer, and he had these mystical experiences where he was shown these little images, vignettes, for each one of the zodiacal signs. And I work with them over the years, and they are amazingly accurate in showing the deeper cosmology of that particular degree. And the eclipse.
I just knew there was going to be a connection because it's all about that fire element, which is centered in the sun, at least from our perspective here on Earth. The fire element lives in the sun.
What it comes down to is the karmic implications of this thing. There were 2 aspects of this that I found so incredible. One was a Hindu sadhu, having completely withdrawn his consciousness from physicality, seeking transcendence in spirit. The other one was Zuni Indians performing a ritual in honor of Mother Earth. And I sat with that and I goes, how do you put these 2 together? And what I came to was that that is really what's asked of us at this time. We have to pop out of this little egoic bubble that defines our reality based on our 5 sensory experience and our cultural matrix. This bubble that we're asking to open up to is much, much bigger. It involves the transcendental realms of spirit, and it involves the immanent realms of the mystery of the feminine, of the earth. And that's what both of those things are saying. We've got to wake up to what is above and beyond this, to the transcendental aspects of being. We have to get to a bigger level, to a higher dimension of consciousness. Like Einstein, you can't solve a problem on the same level of consciousness we're on. So I don't think we'll ever resolve what we're up against until we transcend the limits of where we're stuck right now. It's human consciousness that created this mess that we're stuck in. The folly to me is that we think we're going to save the planet. How are we going to save this planet in the state of consciousness we're in? It's the state of consciousness we're in that created this mess.
You are suggesting, I think, that the eclipse is going to catalyze a shift to a different kind of consciousness.
You know, I don't really know that. Opening up an opportunity. You know, it's like the signs of the zodiac, you know, where the Tao Te Ching, the different cycles of the Tao. We're always in this changing psycho-spiritual emotional environment. And then how do we respond to that? You know, how do we respond to that as conscious, volitional, free will human beings? I think we're given these opportunities. And I think this eclipse is an immense and enormous opportunity for us to reflect, to stop and look at what is going on here.
Because why? What is it that makes an eclipse such an ideal opportunity for that kind of reflection? Just the fact that it's so extreme, so commanding sensorially?
Yes, I think so. And I think traditional people understood, were much more sensitive to subtle energies and subtle levels of consciousness. When all of a sudden the sun, which is the source of all life, the solar deity, all of a sudden the symbol of the feminine of the moon goes across the face of it and blots it out. There's a very deep message in that. The message is that the feminine, which is always the purifying force of the masculine, is saying, okay, we are stopping this total focus on the solar principle. And the solar principle has to be muted, has to come through the feminine principle. In other words, we've got to bring life into this thing.
Did ancient people realize that that was the moon blocking the sun?
You know, our understandings of what they knew, I think, are pretty limited now. I think we, you know, the tendency to think of them as kind of simple, primitive people has been proven to be very faulty.
I agree with you. My understanding is that a lot of these things that we consider very primitive beliefs were actually the fact that they used metaphor in their explanations the way we use science in our explanations.
I think theirs was much more rich and real, with more image. It was actually more holographic in its presentation.
More accessible.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
We're down to these linear, crunchy symbols that are approximations of truth or reality that, like mathematics, they were more linked to really what was going on in nature and the zodiac and things like that, and really deeply connected to it. And that brings us back around to that second Sabian symbol, the Zuni, doing their tribal ceremonies, connecting with the earth. Why, that's the other part of this opportunity. Like, I just begin to experience little bits of up there when I know a thunderstorm is coming, when I feel something changing. I have logbooks from back 40, 50 years. How do we know that the fire season is coming to an end? At a certain time every fall, what you see in the north is this black cloud coming, this circling black cloud. And as it comes closer and closer, you see that it's turkey vultures. And they come and they circle, and then more come up to join the circle. It comes further south a mile, circles more and more join, and does that until it disappears to the south. And 2 to 4 weeks after that happens, the first big storms come and the fire season is open. Lookouts have talked about this for 50, 60 years, have observed this kind of thing, have observed when the bitter cherry are myriad, that means something with the winters, because they live in it. They see it all the time, like the native peoples did. It's a kind of intelligence that we won't get until we get back and get connected with her and awaken it in ourselves.
I'm not sure I even want to know the answer to why. I just think the observation itself is enough. You know, I don't care to know how the turkey vultures know. I'm just ready to admit that they do, and, you know, to bow to them for letting us know that fire season is almost over.
We know that in the womb, the fetus is in complete unity with that mother. And people have issues that go back to things that happened in the womb that they deal with psychologically. Mm-hmm. They were so fused with the consciousness of the mother. If the mother was having problems, they identified that as self. Those problems as their issues. We know that. How does that happen? So there is this level of consciousness that I think that until we activate this, we aren't going to know how to come back into balance with this planet. We can't do it with intellectual processes and technology. And I think that's what the eclipse is saying, is when all these people in the New Age were running back out to Hopi land or wherever and trying to study with the shamans, what they were looking for was trying to open up a different level of this to this different dimension of consciousness that the native peoples had.
That's another whole layer of understanding of natural phenomena.
Oh, yeah.
Is to find how it expresses itself in you. If we're all one, if we really don't end at our skin, and I don't believe we end at our skin.
No.
You know, I think life is a coherent whole of which we are a very small part, and the we is even itself too separate. But whatever is happening to the planet is happening to me. And if I can tune inward and find that You know, that's why I'm so interested in the use of metaphor, because that's so helpful in understanding how that mirroring works.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be really interesting. There's a man named Cliff High. He's a very brilliant man. What he did was he came up with this understanding that we're all psychic and that we don't even know or admit we're psychic. So he started these web crawlers, and something called Half Past Human, and it's web bots. It looks for certain information, emotional reactions that crawls the entire interweb. And he used that to be, then they start to make predictions by looking at levels of coherence on certain topics and psycho-emotional content and level of energy that people were expressing around things. He's been very, very, very successful, which just speaks to what you're saying. And there's many people now, and I find this more and more, I talk to people that feel something big is coming. There's an event coming. Something is going to happen. We're sensing that we're coming to that moment. People know something is about to change. However you look at this, in terms of sustainability, the quote-unquote Seneca cliffs or the overshooting collapse that's appearing in energy, it's appearing in climate change. It's everywhere. It's facing us, and we know it. Something deep. The native peoples have been telling this. Well, the Kogis, you know, the Peruvians, they've been telling us this. The Navajos, the end of the Mayan calendar. We're approaching this moment where major transformation is about to begin.
It might as well happen with the eclipse.
I think we're so darn close, Susan. I mean, I often hear this when I'm meditating. The information age is over. The transformation age is about to begin. And I think that's what we're going to go into. And I think that we're seeing all these things coalescing.
Before I wrap up with Barry, I want to invite listeners, especially those of you who are interested in the astrological sciences, to his website, luminousself.com, where you will find his 20 July essay titled Evolutionary Vectors of the August 21st Solar Eclipse. Here's a somewhat less technical quote from that essay. We are being asked to become truly individualized and free in our soul's expression, no matter the price. Even in the face of powerful opposition to what we know to be true, we must act. The 21 August solar eclipse chart seems to point to the possibility of the beginning of a collective awakening, perhaps catalyzed by the realization of the multitude of intractable and potentially cataclysmic crises humanity faces. Unquote. Does this sound like an invitation to extreme civil disobedience and direct action to you? It sure does to me. Barry also quotes Susan Miller, who had this to say about the deeper meaning of a solar eclipse. The job of an eclipse is to shine a glaring ray of truth to the part of your life that is being touched, and truth will likely arrive in a startling way. Most often we are shocked or surprised by the information that comes to us, for the eclipse is one of the most dramatic tools the universe uses to get you to sit up, pay attention, and take action. Eclipses are always your friends, for they are there to help and protect you. Always be grateful for truth. Unquote. I love this. I'm always grateful for truth, which I spell with an uppercase T in such contexts. So, Barry, while waiting for me to finish production on your analysis of the potential effects of the eclipse energy on the awakening of one particular orange-haired American political leader, is there a shopping cart feature on your website where a person could actually access your books and such?
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's all available at luminousself.com, luminous as in light, self, S-E-L-F, luminousself.com. Yeah, just go on, there's a lot of free stuff on there. We have a self-study thing that you can go in and download modules, audio, and it takes you through the process, or you can work with us directly, whatever you choose.
Process is aimed at awakening consciousness?
Yeah, awaken to the fact that within them is something deeper, more primal, powerful, transcendent, and ultimately even imminent than what they see in the mirror. Call it their soul, call it their true self, call it whatever you want, but it's who and what we really, really are. And when you're in touch with that, that's the pearl of most precious price that the mystics always said. When you have that, you have everything. You're back in touch with the compass of your being that knows truth and reality as it is. It's the compass that we need to be effective, awakened, loving, compassionate human beings.
Well, Elizabeth West likes to say love is the way.
Yes.
And my shamanic mentor, Starwolf, whom I hope to be with for the eclipse, her new book is co-authored with a woman named Nita Gage, and it's called Soul Whispering.
Okay.
And that's basically what it's about, is about awakening that higher inner self, the divine consciousness, so to speak. Nobody I study with in the shamanic world externalizes the divine.
Wonderful.
You know, we're very much into the idea that we're all part of the divine. We are all divine. We all carry divinity, and we've just lost touch with it. I believe that a lot of that has to do with the green god, you know, money. We've sold our souls, basically. I mean, that whole metaphor is very well chosen, I think, you know, selling your soul to the devil.
It's materialism. All the great paths warn of the same thing, materialism. Mm-hmm. If you become focused on materialistic things and lose connection with your soul, it's going to be trouble. All you have to do is go out and look at the world and see what happens. You know, that's exactly that's our work too, from a different perspective approach, but it's
right.
It is the work. It is the essential work that all paths, all true paths and practices are focusing on that one same thing that you discussed.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that to be the case too. It's all one. Even in the world of science, if you're going to throw out half the data, then your theory is bound to be wrong. What we need to do as good scientists or good gurus or good whatever we consider ourselves is to come up with models, metaphors, theories that take into account all of the observable data, not just the kind that we cherry pick that agrees with whatever kind of preconceived notions we bring to the work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
More of them are going to start turning within and finding that their understanding of things greatly expands.
And that's been so frustrating for the activist community, because when you turn your efforts outward, it's very dispiriting.
Mm-hmm.
When you come right down to it, the only one that you are empowered to change is yourself. And that's hard enough.
Yes.
And if you can't do that, what makes you think you're going to change the U.S. Congress or Donald Trump or anything else?
That's our only hope. And it's a great, and that's part of, I think, what the eclipse says, you know, and what the 99 eclipse said as part of that Saros cycle is that's what's asked now. Collective awakening is what is asked. You know, if there is a leap, I think it's a leap in consciousness. And it's where we no longer see ourselves as separate physical ego personalities, but see us as immortal, eternal souls. Definitely have an outward expression of personality and inhabit these forms, but we are so much more than that.
You know, what an enormous gift, what an enormous privilege it is to be here now and not then.
We're witnessing maybe the greatest moment in the story of Earth.
Thank you very much, Barry, for meeting with me again.
You're welcome.
And I will certainly keep you updated with what's going on with Sequitur, and I hope you will keep Sequitur updated with what's going on with those wildfires. You know, what Sequitur is about coming face to face with our own shadow. In other words, internalizing the consequences of our actions. Mm-hmm. And wildfires are just such an enormously powerful wake-up call.
Sure.
So I really appreciated your slant on that. Keep us updated on that.
Yeah. And sure.
I wish you every bit of comfort and safety that you can possibly get up there in that glass tower.
Thank you, Susan. I may need 40 years over.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, and it's been a real joy to be with you again.
All right. You too, Barry. Take good care.
Well, bye-bye.
Bye. That's it for Sequitur Solar Science 2A. Stay tuned for the rest of the Barry Snyder interview and a Sunset Windows practice from Elizabeth West on Sequitur Solar Science 2B, coming in just a few days. Thanks again to Barry Snyder for the interview and for your precious work with the fire elemental, to Deba Kale Earnshaw for her rendering of Tim Barrett's poem And Then There Were None, to Takashi Tanimori for the clear and honest mirror in which we can view a glaring aspect of our cultural shadow, to Benjamin the Donkey for help with hosting the show, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.